Marx said that the emancipation of the working class is the task of the working class. Words which many people have forgotten but remain correct. Only the working class can free itself. Nobody can free the working class. We're not looking for saviors or messiahs or anything like that. The source, the only way in which we can change society is basing ourselves on the masses, on the majority of the population, which is the working class. Now, why did Marx say this? It's necessary to go over the ABCs. Ted Grant always used to say, make about this. You must always repeat and repeat and repeat, because people forget. It's astonishing. And many people have forgotten, many people who call themselves Marxists have forgotten the ABCs of Marxism. Why is it that Marx and Engels always insisted on the special role of the working class? Why couldn't it be the peasantry? Or the middle class, or the intellectuals, or the students, or the lumpen proletariat? Why is it the proletariat? Why is it the working class? The only class that can carry through the process transformation of society. And what's the reason? Is it because maybe workers are better looking than students, or more intelligent than students, or more moral than students? No, well, I mean, some workers are good looking, some are not so good looking. Some are clever, some are not so clever. Some are moral, some are not so moral. Doesn't make any difference. There's nothing to do with it. It's not an arbitrary question. It's because of the role of the working class in production, particularly in modern large-scale industry. That's the question. A worker, for example, who enters into industry, enters into collective production, social production. That's reflected in the psychology of the working class. It's also reflected in the methods of struggle of the working class, which, if you think about it, are collective methods of struggle. Common Harry Whittaker, years of marvelous experience, veteran of the trade union movement, Harry knows all about this. That what are the methods of struggle of the proletariat? The methods of struggle of the proletariat are the mass strike, and before you have a strike, you have a democratic assembly, a mass meeting, you discuss, you debate the pros, the contras, and at the end, the majority decides, and the minority must accept what the majority says. And you have a strike, which is a collective thing, or a mass demonstration. These are the methods, or an insurrection if it comes to that. These are the classical methods of the proletariat. Now, that's not true of any other class. You see, social being determines consciousness, Marx said, which means that the way in which you live ultimately must determine the way that you think. It determines your class psychology. You could take any other class. Students, for example. The students end up taking competitive exams, after which most of them will become doctors, lawyers, teachers. These are individualistic professions. Changed a bit nowadays with teachers and things like that. But nevertheless, a small businessman, that's your middle class. Or a small peasant even. The peasantry perhaps is the class which is closest to the working class. The middle class is very heterogeneous, incidentally. There's all kinds of shadings of the middle class. But the middle class psychology is a bourgeois psychology. It's characterized generally by individualism. You see that the if you have the misfortune of going to university as I did, you know all about petty bourgeois individualism. And generally students don't understand the collective things and collective activity, collective discipline. They're allergic to discipline. That's why anarchism, which is a petty bourgeois variant of socialism or communism, is so popular among students. You know, if you see a demonstration in the street, whether it's in Jakarta or in London, it doesn't matter, you don't have to be told, oh, this is a demonstration of students and this is a demonstration of workers. You know straight away. There's a different, an entirely different way of organizing these demonstrations. Workers understand discipline. If they don't understand it, they don't understand it when they join the workforce, they soon will understand it, because or they'll get the sack. You know, you clock on at a time, at a certain time, you clock off at a certain time, you work at a certain speed. Workers learn these things. It's part of their life. It doesn't apply to students, for example. Or least of all to peasants, Marx said. The peasantry, perhaps, as I say, particularly in countries like, of course, in Indonesia, the peasantry is a very important revolutionary force. But they don't have the same mentality as the workers. They don't have the same attitude towards the struggle. The struggle is the workers. Marx said that the peasants, he said that there's no more link, there's no more connection between peasants than potatoes in a sack. Each one has got his own particular individual plot of land, which he works without reference to anybody else. And even the landless peasants, which is the closest, they're, formally speaking, you could say that they're proletarians. Rural proletarians, because they don't own land. They're not property owners, like a small peasant. Yes, but normally, if you ask yourself, what is the aspiration of a landless peasant? Think of it, is to have land. The normal slogan, that was the case in Russia before 1917. Land to the peasant. But that's a slogan, that's not a socialist slogan. That's a slogan to create a large class of small proprietors. Now we have to be a little bit careful on that because it has changed somewhat. In Spain, for example, during the Spanish Revolution in the 1930s, many of the peasants, which is an astonishing fact, developed collective consciousness, partly under the influence of the anarchists, to give them their due. In India, you've had that development. So it's not entirely a simple question, but historically speaking, the aspiration of the peasantry was a petty bourgeois aspiration. And guerrilla war and individual terrorism are not the methods of the proletariat. They're individualistic methods of struggle. Both guerrilla warfare and in particular individual terrorism are the methods of struggle of the petty bourgeoisie and the lumpen proletariat. Not the working class. Nothing to do with the traditions of the working class. And certain things flow from this. Certain things. Now, the Russian Marxists, people have forgotten this. I mean, particularly the sects who've forgotten everything and learned nothing. The ultra-left sects which infest the periphery of the labour movement have forgotten the ABCs of Marxism. They embraced individual terrorism. For example, in Ireland, in Palestine and other places, they embraced it. It's a very good thing. Ted Grant told me on several occasions, Mick perhaps would have heard him say this. He said he once had a debate going back to the late 60s, I think it was the late 60s, when these ideas of terrorism became fashionable. He once had a debate with Tony Cliff, who was the ideologue, the theoretician, so-called, of the British SWP. He once had a debate with Cliff, and Cliff actually said, in Ted's presence, he says, well, it seems nowadays, this is the late 1960s, in order to make a revolution, you don't need the working class, you don't need a mass struggle, you don't need a trade union, so you don't need a party. All you need is three men and a gallon of petrol. Actually said this, and Ted was astonished. And all the sects went after terrorism, and supported terrorism with disastrous results in every single case, particularly in South America, Latin America, but I'll deal with that, but in every case it led to a complete massacre and the destruction of the movement. It set the movement back for a long time. But let's go back to the roots of this question, the historical and theoretical roots of the attitude of Marxism towards terrorism. What these gentlemen have forgotten is that Marxism, and particularly Russian Marxism, was born in an implacable struggle against individual terrorism. Implacable struggle. Now, before I say anything else on this subject, let's make it clear. We are not pacifists. We don't condemn terrorism because of moralistic reasons. We don't condemn terrorism because for the same reason that the bourgeois reject terrorism. It's all the time, isn't it? Every day on the television, terrorism, the war on terror, terrorism this, terrorism that, without analysing the content of it. The fact of the matter is that the worst kind of terrorism, the most brutal type of terrorism, is state terrorism. Let's never forget that. It's the bourgeoisie, it's the ruling class that possesses the arms, the weapons, the police, the army, the prisons, the torturers, the secret police. That's the state. It's not any left-wing group. The consequence of that, you saw that in Indonesia in 1965, terrible, where they murdered, with the active intervention of the CIA, these so-called Democrats, who now talk about terrorism this and terrorism that, they murdered how many people in Indonesia? 2 million? 2 million people, slaughtered, heads chopped off, and men, women and children, massacred. That was supported by America. It was organized by America. So let's not confuse this matter. We are not pacifists. Our task is to overthrow the bourgeois state. Our criticism of terrorism is not the hypocrisy of Bush. Bush is the worst terrorist of the lot. And therefore, when he criticizes terrorism and he attacks terrorism, it's from the standpoint of the worst kind of terrorism, which is the state terrorism of the ruling class. We have nothing to do with that. We can't be identified with that in any sense, shape, or form. Our criticism of terrorism is not that at all. Our criticism of terrorism is that it is counterproductive and it does not work. And it has the opposite effect to what is intended from the standpoint of the working class. Incidentally, I want to put forward an idea which you might like to consider, because some of these petty bourgeois liberal types talk about moralism. Moralism. They accuse Marxists that we're not moral. Well, I'll tell you what is moral. There's no such thing as a super historical morality. Morality is a class morality. What is there's an English proverb, you know, one man's meat is another man's poison. And it applies to morality. What is good for one class is not good for another class. It's bad for, you see that in any strike, Harry, you know, you don't strike. What do the bosses say? This is very bad. And the workers say, this is very good. And both are right. From their own class point of view, both are correct, of course. So it's not a moral question. But if you ask me, what is moral? We have a morality. We have a morality. We have a very stern, very strict moral, proletarian morality. That is moral, which serves the cause of the socialist revolution and serves to raise the consciousness of the working class. And serves to inspire the working class with confidence in themselves as a class. That is negative. That is reactionary. That is bad. That is immoral, which serves to lower the consciousness of the working class and hinders the cause of socialism. It's a very simple matter. The equation, if you like, I want you to think about it. But let's go back to what I was saying. Russian Marxism specifically was born in an implacable struggle against terrorism, against individual terrorism. Now, what individual terrorism are we talking about? It's not the type of terrorism you get today, which is a complete abomination. Things that groups like Al Qaeda and so on, that kind of terrorism, it's a complete, that's disgusting. The type of terrorism which Lenin and also the Mensheviks, all the Russian Marxists opposed, was a widespread movement among the Russian students. That's why I repeat the point. It's a petty bourgeois thing. It's a student thing. But you see, you can have some sympathy for these students. You could have some sympathy 100 years ago. You could have sympathy for these young students. They were very, very good people, actually. They were very sincere people. They were sincere revolutionaries. They were sincerely conducting a struggle against a monstrous state. The Russian Tsarist state was a monstrously oppressive autocracy. No democracy, no rights, no elections, no free trade unions, no parties, except bourgeois parties. Okay, I mean, under these circumstances, young people could be, and furthermore, the most important point, no working class, originally. The Russian working class only started to develop after 1861, the time of the emancipation of the serfs, and only really developed in the 80s and particularly the 90s of the 19th century. So the Russian working class was quite a young working class. That's the reason why Marx never included Russia when he was talking about his perspectives for socialism. It didn't apply. When Marx was alive, there was no working class in Russia to speak of. It only developed in the 1890s in particular. That's a separate question. But there were a group of the best elements of society, if you like, young people, young idealistic students who hated this regime and who were determined to overthrow the regime. And when they looked around society for a point of support, they couldn't find any. There was no working class, so they could be forgiven. We could forgive them this. Therefore, they looked to the peasantry. They tried going to the people. That's why they were called narodniks. The Russian word narodniks, what, Harry? Narod.
Narod is a country, nation, national.
People, actually.
Yeah.
People. The go to the people. They tried going to the peasants, but the peasants were so backward, so illiterate, so ignorant that. And they didn't like the look of these young city gents, you know. And they tried to dress themselves up as peasants. Not very successfully. Peasants just had to look at their hands to see if they were not peasants. So very often they would beat them up and they would hand them over to the police, frequently. Peasants would have nothing to do with them. And therefore, what was the student supposed to do? What was the intelligentsia supposed to do? Therefore, they resorted to what was known as propaganda of the deed. Terrorism. They set up an organization, a very successful organization, probably the most successful terrorist organization that ever existed in history, called the Narodnaya Volya, the people's will, or the people's freedom. You can pass it either way. A very tightly, by the way, it's not correct to describe these people as anarchists, which are sometimes read this. How could they be anarchists? They had a very strict, centralized, disciplined revolutionary clandestine organization, which conducted terrorist acts, not like Al-Qaeda, by the way. In comparison to Al-Qaeda and people like that, these guys were, I say guys, these people, because there were women also, like Vera Asuras, who were involved in this. These men and women, courageous young men and women, they were like saints. They were very moralistic, very idealistic. They only killed known torturers, police chiefs, people of this character, and after they conducted an assassination, usually they'd hand themselves over to the police. Not like these monsters today. They are monsters who plant bombs in marketplaces, killing men, women, and children, so that's disgusting. The Narodniks were not, the Narodnaya Volya people were not like that. And despite the fact that they were well-intentioned, and all that, very idealistic, and all that, and they only had limited targets. The idea that they had was to provoke a mass movement. And ultimately, they succeeded in inverted commas. They killed the Tsar. I mean, what more can you ask? They assassinated the Tsar, the head of state. And the idea was that there'd be a huge uprising of the people. Nothing of the sort occurred. Nothing. That's why I say that terrorism, individualism, we criticize it because it's counterproductive. That's the reason. It does not attack the state. They talk about, the Palestinians talk about this, what do they call it? Armed struggle. Where's the armed struggle? There never has been an armed struggle against the Israeli state. There's been individual acts of individual terrorism. There still are. And every time that happens, the Israeli state, they rub their hands in glee. They're very happy. Because these terrorist acts serve to strengthen the state. The whole conception is based upon a series of fundamental errors. Let's start with the first error. The first error is that the ruling class is not based on individuals. The state does not depend on individuals. You can kill as many individuals as you like. You kill as many torturers, jailers, police. It might give you a personal satisfaction. We wouldn't lose any sleep over the fact that you kill that an individual bastard, if you like, loses his life. You know, we might even derive personal satisfaction, but that's a very misguided satisfaction. Because you kill one bastard and he's replaced by an even worse bastard, that's all. There's no shortage of bastards in bourgeois society. There's a very huge reservoir of and usually they're replaced by even more reactionary people, even worse people than the one that was killed. So this is based on a fallacy. A fundamental mistake. The second point is that these acts of individual terrorism serve to strengthen the state. It does not weaken the state in the slightest degree. It doesn't even dent the state. We had an argument with a comrade, an ex-comrade, he is now in relation to Hamas. He said we should support Hamas. But you see, Hamas, every time they lob rockets onto Israeli settlements. Now, we understand that the conditions of the Palestinian masses is desperate. We understand this. We understand that there's a hatred against the Israeli oppressors. Can't read your writing. You mean I've got another 2 hours to go? That's good. There's this burning hatred. Now, we understand this. We sympathize with it. And we should always sympathize with the oppressed minority or the oppressed nation or the oppressed people against the oppressor. We're not neutral in the struggle. We're not neutral in the struggle between the Palestinians and the Israelis. We're on the side of the Palestinians. But you see, the method is wrong. These rockets that they're launching, to take a specific example, they're launching rockets from the Gaza Strip into Israeli territory to drop on Israeli settlements. This is a very blunt instrument. And you bet your bottom dollar, you bet any money going, that one day, perhaps tomorrow, One of these rockets will fall on a school, an Israeli school, will kill school kids, or in a hospital. And what do you think will happen? No, it will happen. That's what the Israelis are waiting for. Not the Israelis, the Israeli ruling class, the Israeli military. They will mercilessly crush the people of Gaza. There's no contest. No contest from a military point of view. And every time one of these actions is perpetrated, it strengthens the state. To go back to Russia, the assassination of the Tsar did not provoke a revolution. It provoked a long period of severe repression. And the repression is not just directed against the terrorists. The repression is directed against everybody. Like now, after the 9th of September, the repression in America is not just directed against, not mainly directed against Al-Qaeda. It's mainly directed against the working class, the left wing, the students, progressive people. The laws are being made more reactionary in order to combat this and so on. In other words, I repeat the point, it's completely counterproductive. And Russian Marxism, Lenin, Trotsky, all the Russian Marxists conducted an implacable struggle against this. They described the Russian Narodnovolchi, the terrorists. They had a phrase. They said they were these people, they said, the Russian terrorists, they said, is a liberal with a bomb. Now then, that's something to think about. How can a terrorist be a liberal with a bomb? It's a contradiction in terms. What's a terrorist got to do with a liberal? Well, he's got a lot to do. Because it's the same petty bourgeois psychology, the same mentality. Let's take it by stages. Most of these kids in Russia and all the other countries where you get this taking place are what they call it in French, they call fils de papa. You know what that means? Daddy's boys. Daddy's boys. Sons and daughters of the rich. Okay? Which for a few years in their life they become free from their parents. Let's take daddy to start with. Let's take papa. Papa is a liberal politician in Russia. Liberal politician, a banker, believes in some kind of democracy, believes in peaceful reform and so on and so forth. Or to cite a modern example, a social democrat, a reformer, a Blairite. Okay, what do these guys say? They're liberals also. What do they say? They say, I am a man of the people. I believe in progress. But there's a small problem. The people are ignorant. People don't understand politics. I understand politics. Therefore, you must vote for me. I will enter the parliament and I will carry out progressive measures in your name. Okay, but the people remain mere spectators. They don't play any active role whatsoever. Then along comes the son or daughter that's been a few years in university, has become separated from the family, becomes temporarily able to think critically about society. What does this person say? I am a revolutionary. I'm for the revolution. I'm for the working class. But there's a problem. When I go to the working class with my leaflets calling for the overthrow of capitalism, they don't understand the word that I'm talking about. They don't get any echo. The workers are ignorant. The workers are backward. Therefore, what do? I take a pistol and a gallon of petrol, to use Cliff's expression, a bomb, and I carry out the social revolution in the name of the working class. The working class doesn't enter into it as a factor. I repeat Marx's expression, the task of the emancipation of the working class is the task of the working class alone. No, this idea of students and intellectuals set up terrorist groups and act in the name of the working class. But the working class doesn't enter into this, is not consulted about it, is not asked their opinion. In other words, they remain as passive observers. Now, this is a very negative thing from our point of view. This precisely serves to decrease. Let me rephrase that. Even when they succeed in their objectives, and sometimes they do succeed in killing, the Russians succeeded in killing the Tsar. What more do you want? Even when they succeed, it's a negative thing because it tends to lower the confidence of the working class in themselves. Let me give you some examples. From Latin America, which is the most tragic case, absolutely appalling, and the sects here played a very dirty role, an appalling role, particularly the Mandalites of the so-called Fourth International, a disgusting role. We oppose this.